My talk tonight is about the seven factors of enlightenment, and more specifically, one of those factors, investigation. You know, for many, many years, I've heard and read about the seven factors of awakening. I would read through them, spend some time considering how they relate to each other and to several other key teachings. I recognize that I do practice with them, although without naming them individually. And gradually I forget their details. It's clear to me, though, that they're important for achieving awakening. For this talk, though, I wanted to delve more into how they work, because I know a lot of people think that awakening or enlightenment or nirvana is some remote goal that they'll never reach. And I've gotten to think that they probably are asking, what have the seven factors of awakening done for me lately? So I did some research and I came up with two suttas that talk about the daily life benefits of the seven factors of awakening. In one, the Buddha visits a monk who he knows has been in pain and asks if he's feeling better. The monk says, no, still feeling pretty miserable. So the Buddha encourages him to practice with the seven factors of awakening, saying, when cultivated and developed, this teaching leads to perfect wisdom, to nirvana. Well, yes, I thought as I read that, we know that part, but this guy is in pain now. But then I read on, where after this tutorial that the Buddha has given, the sick monk rose from that illness. There and then, that ailment vanished. And I thought, oh, great. Now we're like some religious sects that pray their illnesses away and refuse medical treatment. And then it struck me. This is my story about how I established a regular meditation practice. About 30 years ago, soon after I was diagnosed with a neurological disease that involves a lot of full-body pain, a friend took me to meditate at Berkeley Zen Center. The first time that I meditated at home after that, I saw that my pain had become manageable. It was a great relief, and it motivated me to keep practicing. And it still does. At that point, I knew nothing about the seven factors, but just derailing my usual self-centered train of thought did better than any of the pills that the doctors were giving me. There's another sutta that hits real close to, if not on, ground zero. It's the Buddha who's down with a grievous illness. One of the senior monks sat with him and recited the factors of awakening, and his serious illness vanished. A modern commentator noted that the mind and body are not separate, and unwholesome and harmful thoughts can cause disaster. He said, when concentrated on right or wise understanding, the mind can be a powerful influence for healing. Now, before you put the seven factors away, like at the top of your medicine cabinet, at least until you have a grievous illness hit you, let's remember that happiness is the goal for all beings, not just you and your friends or humanity, but it's really obvious. All animals want to be happy. There are just different ways of getting there or ideas about how to get there. Now, I presume that you're listening to this talk because you think meditation and the Buddhist teachings might help you get there. We should bear in mind that Buddhist teachings serve as a how-to manual for practice. They're not about esoteric concepts that we need to learn. They're about ways to practice. Even if at first reading, they seem totally abstract. If you went onto my website and listened to the 20-minute talk I gave almost 3 years ago, you probably have an idea of what the seven factors are. It may help to remember that the number one factor, which enables us to use the next six, is mindfulness. The next six factors are divided into three energizing and three calming factors: investigation, energy, and joy empower us to delve into the causes of suffering or happiness. And then we're calmed by serenity, concentration, and equanimity. When the mind is still, it absorbs better what we learn from engaging with the Dharma experientially. And I'll explain that as we go along. So we need to be energetic for that engagement, and then let a still mind digest it. As I implied earlier, I'm going to focus in this talk on one of these remaining six factors, the first of the energizing factors, and that is investigation. It's actually fairly representative of what the seven factors of awakening are about. Investigation is about paying attention. I often urge meditators to notice this or that, which means turn the attention toward the phenomena I'm talking about, or be alert for them to arise in the mind. Mindfulness practice is not passive. Even though we do start out using concentration to quiet the mind, we're just watching the breath over and over and returning to it. But once the mind stops bombarding us with trivial or repetitive thinking, those thoughts that carry a heavy emotional load will reveal themselves and the emotions they carry. That's what we should investigate. You're completely justified in asking, well, how are we supposed to investigate them? Isn't meditation supposed to be free of thoughts? Well, the answer is a little yes and mostly no. Meditation should be more free of the trivial repetitive thoughts, yes. But there definitely are kinds of mental activity that we should use to investigate strong thoughts and emotions that arise, either in meditation or in daily life. And we want to investigate these experiences that arise by paying attention to the experience of having these thoughts. Generally, this means wondering how these mind states cause the mind and body to feel. Techniques to investigate our experience range from quiet contemplation to mentally asking questions. The most common question is, "What is this?" But I'll talk about others in a minute. Contemplation reminds me of letting a candy melt on the tongue. We just hold the thought and our questions about it gently, sort of at arm's length, and let it reveal its subtle content. It's also a bit like Hamlet asking questions of poor Yorick, a skull that he's found in the graveyard. Being mostly a skull, Yorick is slow to reply. So most people want to jump ahead of him and figure out the answers themselves. That's not the appropriate kind of thinking. The process needs to be less mentally active. Our intellects don't have and can't generate the kind of answers that we're seeking. There is a subtle element of analysis that's involved in this factor of investigation. And it comes into play in identifying cause and effect, but particularly in choosing the question or concern that we want to examine. Our analysis may observe that an insistent thought is accompanied by feelings of, for example, dissatisfaction and anger. The thought certainly seems to cause those feelings, and I think we can proceed on that assumption. When we notice this, we're tempted to analyze who was wrong in making us feel this way. This is not the kind of analysis we should pursue. Investigation, as I've said, relies on how attention is focused. That's what the suttas call appropriate attention. The Buddha directly addressed what made attention appropriate in the Sabbasava Sutta, which is subtitled, and I'll paraphrase, on all the products of the mind. The Buddha said often that the uninstructed, run-of-the-mill person doesn't discern what ideas are fit for attention and what ideas are unfit for attention. He said that, well, I'll paraphrase, the way the Buddha said, such people attend inappropriately. they wonder, do I exist? Do I not exist? What am I? How is it that I exist? Where has this being come from? Where is it bound? Did I exist in the past? What was I in the past? How did I come to exist in the past? Will I exist in the future? How shall I exist in the future? What will I be in the future? In other words, most people are paying attention to thoughts about me, 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 and I, me, and mine, kind of throughout time and space. Quote, this leads to convoluted questions about self. This very self of mine, the knower that is sensitive, this is the self of mine that is constant, everlasting, eternal, not subject to change, and will endure as long as eternity. The Buddha said, this is called a thicket of views, a fetter of views. Bound by a fetter of views, the uninstructed run-of-the-mill person is not free from birth, aging, and death, from sorrow, lamentation, pain, distress, and despair. He is not free, I tell you, from stress. And just so we're clear, stress, as used here, means dukkha or suffering. So that is not an appropriate way to investigate our internal experience, our thoughts and emotions. The sutta goes on to say that in contrast to such untrained people, the well-taught disciple of the noble ones discerns what ideas are fit for attention and what ideas are unfit for attention. The Buddha said, he attends appropriately. This is stress. This is the origination of stress. This is the cessation of stress. This is the way leading to the cessation of stress. You may have caught on that that last sentence recaps the Four Noble Truths. One, life is usually full of suffering. Two, dukkha or suffering is caused by clinging. Three, it can be ended. And four, the way to end it is the Eightfold Path. So what does this tell us about appropriate attention? When in doubt, how do we know if the way we're investigating our internal experience uses appropriate attention or not? Well, in a nutshell, we notice whether our investigation is concerned with dukkha and ending our suffering, or if it's all tied up with concerns centered around ourself. Isn't that what our brains work on most of the time? Scattered concerns orbiting around ourselves? That mental activity is not the investigation that's intended in the seven factors of awakening. Dukkha, I need to say at this point, it's not ours. We think of suffering as belonging to us, my suffering. being a part of who we are. In some ways, it can dent and twist us into different personalities, especially if we view it this way. You know, I think it really helps to recognize that all beings suffer. See an animal caught in a trap or confined in a cage. You'll see suffering. Dukkha is not an element of our being, but an experience that arises and passes away for all sentient beings and belongs to no one. So now, when a big, insistent thought seizes your attention during meditation or in daily life, take the time to see how it's affecting you. Does it have an emotional impact? Investigate that. Investigate it experientially. Hold it like a candy on your tongue, or like Yorick's skull in your outstretched hand. What does it feel like? What does it taste like? As I said before, investigation is not about figuring things out intellectually. We just lead our attention to explore, guided by the Four Noble Truths, and ask, is this mental state one that involves suffering? If so, what is its cause? Can it be ended? And how can it be ended? We want to be sure not to analyze suffering rationally, but experientially. What is the felt sense of this thought and the dukkha it causes? How, in other words, does it make us feel? Many people are afraid to feel dukkha, so they avoid this vital part of the investigation. And it's true. It's probably going to be uncomfortable, at least at first. But it's really the same suffering that we will experience even without being aware of it. It will lurk in the back of our minds. And if we don't examine it and thus root it out, it goes on growing. It becomes an ongoing, though maybe low-level, torment for us. And it will continue to warp our perceptions and understanding of our experience. In contrast, like an abscessed tooth that we take to the dentist, although it may hurt to have them root around and release that discharge, once we have done the same sort of thing with the dukkha we experience, the pain soon subsides and the infection heals. If we don't examine it, if we don't investigate it, it's just going to stick around. And it's probably going to get worse. And by not knowing really that it's there, where it came from, and what can cure it, it's probably going to continue to cause us a great deal of suffering. I should note that some of the powerful thoughts you have may be delightful. They are also worth exploring and savoring, definitely. just look, though, to see if there's any clinging to that delight, or whether you're prepared for it to pass away, because it will. I want to end with a quote by the great teacher Ajahn Chah from his book, A Still Forest Pool. This isn't a poem, but it comes across that way. He said, try to be mindful and let things take their natural course. Then your mind will become still in any surroundings, like a clear forest pool. All kinds of wonderful, rare animals will come to drink at the pool, and you will clearly see the nature of all things. You will see many strange and wonderful things come and go, but you will be still. This is the happiness of the Buddha. And I just want to emphasize that this happiness is not a far-off future ideal. It's part of our lives here and now when we are mindful. Thank you.